Welcome back to the Country House podcast. Today, following on from our episode about Sir John Vanbrugh, we're going to be delving into his magnum opus, Blenheim Palace. Now called Palace, but it's the only non-episcopal, non-royal palace that we have. But I wanted to start off with our catchphrase. We've sort of been known for a phrase of this house is blah, blah, blah. But first and foremost, it is a family home. But actually going off people like Alexander Pope, who have said that Blenheim was the most inhospitable thing imaginable. In a word, the hall is a most expensive absurdity. So quite controversial. But perhaps that is because it was essentially a monument to victory, you know. And so my question opening this to you both is Blenheim sort of the Victor Emmanuel II monument of Britain?
Blenheim was given to the first Duke of Marlborough, John Churchill, by a grateful nation for his victory at the Battle of Blenheim. And it was three things. It was a monument to victory, it was a mausoleum, and it was a family home. And the controversy surrounded basically how those three aspects were squared into one building. And we'll talk more in this episode about the many controversies that surrounded the choice of the Duke in appointing Vanbrugh as the architect, Vanbrugh's strained relationship with the Duchess of Marlborough, and indeed the scandals over the financing of the palace and the eventual great falling out that so many people talk about and know about. But I think it'll be helpful perhaps for Connor to describe to us how Blenheim looks for our listeners out there, perhaps those who haven't visited it or haven't seen it, as well as those who have. What do you see? I know there are two main approaches to Blenheim.
Yes, Connor, perhaps entering you can outline what you see from the estate approaches. From the village of Woodstock, you enter through the East Gate, and this is a triumphal arch based on the design of the Arch of Titus. And it's above that arch that it denotes the year Blenheim Palace was built, who it was built by and for whom, which is the Duke of Marlborough, and bestowed upon him by a grateful nation. And it's upon entering that gate that you have an expansive view across a mature parkland of oak, chestnut, and a serpentine lake that was not the creation of Brown. This is Capability Brown in the 1760s. At the time of the fourth Duke, but rather it was a formal lake which Brown flooded to create what we see today. And meandering around that lake, you approach this Baroque palace, which glows golden in the sun, honeycomb stone, and it has finials, turrets, chimneys, all cast across the skyline, creating a beautiful silhouette. Entering into the courtyard, then in front of the house, it is 90 meters across. And on one side, you have the kitchen wing, and on the other, the stable wing. But at the centerpiece, the crowning glory, is the portico and the battle trophies that are carved and surmounted within the architecture.
That's really helpful. I think thinking about the design of the palace, we can't avoid talking about Sir John Vanbrugh, whose life and politics and ideology we talked about in last week's episode. And it's interesting that John Vanbrugh wasn't the first choice to build Blenheim Palace. Christopher Wren was still alive when Blenheim was commissioned, and Christopher Wren was the first choice of the Duchess of Marlborough, who was a very ambitious woman. Sarah Jennings married John Churchill and climbed the greasy pole of Queen Anne's court to become her confidant and right-hand woman. And the Duchess of Marlborough wanted Sir Christopher Wren, but it's said that the Duke of Marlborough met John Vanbrugh at one of his at a playhouse, actually, because we know, as we talked about last week, that John Vanbrugh was a dramatist. He was an untrained architect who had an extraordinary eye and was a very good artist and was able to draw houses beautifully, but he relied on his sidekick, Nicholas Hawksmoor, with whom he worked in conjunction to actually turn his drawings and plans into bricks and mortar. So Vanbrugh was appointed much to the anger and chagrin of the Duchess, and really their relationship was strained from the very start, because the Duke had appointed Vanbrugh against her wishes. But it's important to realise that Blenheim is one of the few outstanding examples of English Baroque, along with Castle Howard, which was John Vanbrugh's first commission. And actually, it's interesting that because of the scandals that surrounded Blenheim, Vanbrugh didn't get many more commissions after Blenheim. He became quite unpopular in the architecture world. And it's interesting that his final commission, which was Seton Delaval Hall, which we touched on last week in our episode on Vanbrugh, is a more refined and Palladian example of English Baroque that Vanbrugh ended up reverting to because he was accused of overspending, extravagance, ostentation.
And not only that, he was banned from the building site of Blenheim by the Duchess, and so was his wife, which is, it just shows you the lengths that she went to prohibit his continued involvement in the project, which of course was finished by Hawksmoor.
That's right. It's when Blenheim was built, it was built in the early 18th century, and it was at that point, as Connor mentioned, before Capability Brown was commissioned to landscape the park, it was primarily surrounded by formal gardens. And the beauty of Blenheim today is that it still has some formal gardens as well as its Capability Brown parkland. The reason why the park is so beautiful at Blenheim is because it was a royal domain. It was a deer hunting park before it was given by the monarch and the nation to the Churchill family. So there wasn't a principal house before, but there was already a beautiful park, a deer park, which was used for hunting. And so it was a great location to build a monument. And indeed, there are many monuments in the grounds of Blenheim. There's an obelisk, there's Follies. And of course, the great Vanbrugh Bridge, which was part submerged when Brown flooded the lake. So our listeners can see if they read about this, they can see what the Blenheim Bridge looked like before and after the lake was flooded. And the bridge is quite an extraordinary piece of architecture in its own right, although now you can only see the top half of the bridge because most of it is submerged underwater.
Yes, Jeff, predating the house, King Henry I, his hunting lodge built in 1129, that was enlarged over the years. And you can see from prints of how it appears that it has turrets and castellated towers and small additions, pointed arched windows, mullion windows of different sizes. So it's very much an organic growth from a hunting lodge into a royal manor. King Henry II called it Woodstock as a royal manor, and there were 7 miles of walls. Now, this was attacked during the Civil War, and it was in quite a dilapidated state. And the first Duke of Marlborough suggested moving into the house, that it was perfectly suitable to fix, repair, and move back in. And interestingly, Vanbrugh had started work on repairs when the Duchess, upon finding this out, had the manor demolished.
Have you heard the story of Henry II, his mistress? I always enjoy that story from Woodstock. he kept his mistress in a secret cabin building that was only accessible via a very intricate labyrinth. Now, Henry II's wife, who I can't remember her name, she managed to navigate this very intricate labyrinth out of curiosity and suspecting that there was a mistress there. And upon successfully finding the mistress, she rather sadistically offered her a dagger or a chalice of poison. And she chose the poison and died. But there's a piece of history for you there in Woodstock. But now going to Blenheim, in its grandeur, and name, it is a palace. You know, there were I heard there were 1,500 workmen on it, and it took 7 years to paint the interior. And I don't know if you've seen the painting of, I think it's on the ceiling of the Great Hall, with the Duke of Marlborough kneeling to Britannia, presenting a map of the Battle of Blenheim. It's quite remarkable. But given that, why is it called a palace if technically it isn't?
I think it's simply called a palace because it was named as such by the king and the nation, because it is such an extra, it is a monument. It's not just a private family home. I think that's the only explanation I can come up with, unless there's another reason behind it. It is a palace, but then there are many houses that could be called palaces, Chatsworth and Castle Howard amongst them. I think it was because it was built as a monument rather than just as a home that it was given the title palace. But it's interesting, based on that, just going back to the architecture, Vanbrugh designed the house to be viewed as a monument. So he designed it, he planned Blenheim in perspective, which means it's best viewed from a distance. And I think in some writing about it, it talks about how it was Vanbrugh's vision was to portray the palace as a bastion or a citadel, the true monument and home to a great warrior. So it was to almost appear like a heavenly vision of the New Jerusalem that we read about in Revelation, this sort of golden city. And Blenheim does look, because of its silhouette against the landscape and against the sky, with its turrets, its finials, its urns, its various heights, its columns, especially some of those columns which are tapered to make it look even, to make them look even taller and make the building look even grander than it actually is. Vanbrugh's vision was to create this golden gleaming city that was to shine as a beacon of victory across the landscape. Connor mentioned the approaches to the palace. There is the approach from the town of Woodstock, but there's also a long straight drive through wrought iron grates that go directly onto the great court. So there are these two different approaches, the traditional straight approach that runs down an avenue of trees over the bridge and up into the great court, and then there's the winding one that Connor mentioned that goes through the east gate, the triumphal arch, which interestingly is more Egyptian in design than Roman. There are a lot of Italian influences which are typical of the Baroque style, but the east gate is very blocky and square, which is more Egyptian in style. And again, Vanbrugh used this optical illusion by tapering the walls, so it actually goes up slightly, almost like a pyramid, which is what gives it its Egyptian style. The walls go slope gently inwards as it goes up, thus creating an illusion of even greater height. But again, you know, many of the accusations that were thrown against Vanbrugh, apart from his extravagance and overspending, were that he wasn't practical, that he didn't create a practical family home. But this is countered by the fact that this east gate actually doubles as the palace's water tower. So the upper half of the gate, which is solid stone, there's no balustrading, is actually a water tower that provided water for the palace.
Yes, the house is very much architecturally flamboyant. It's designed to awe and inspire, and it does that as much today as it did upon its construction. And it was the fourth Duke who inherited at 18. He spent his wealth wisely. He built on the landscape. He changed it into what we see it today by employing brown. He also built a collection of furniture, which you can see in the library and in the drawing room throughout the house. But why Blenheim is probably most famous to us today is that it's where Churchill was born. And this was just by chance that his parents were invited to Blenheim for a shooting weekend. And there are two reasons why they said the birth was brought on prematurely. One was that they were dancing in the library, but the other, and perhaps the true reason, was that the carriage ride, and particularly the cobbles of Blenheim, brought about the the pregnancy. And Churchill famously said that he made the two greatest decisions of his life were to be born at Blenheim and married. And he's content with both of those decisions.
Following on from what Connor's told us already about Winston Churchill being born at Blenheim, we should note that the reason why he holds the same surname is because his father, Lord Randolph Churchill, was a younger son of the then Duke of Marlborough. So Churchill was the son of a younger son, so he was never in line to inherit Blenheim. But he, being a cousin of the Duke, the future Duke, and being the nephew of the present Duke at the time, they would often go to Blenheim. And I think it was at Blenheim as well that Churchill got engaged to Clemmy, his wife. It was his favorite place in the world, and he adored Blenheim. But that is what Blenheim is possibly most famous for now, is Churchill's birthplace. But it's interesting that Churchill's mother, of course, was American, Jenny Jerome, and it's interesting that Lord Randolph Churchill married an American to help him keep up his extravagant life, because obviously America was booming at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, and a lot of money was being made in the New World. And so he married an heiress, Jenny Jerome, but she pales in comparison to the heiress that the 9th Duke of Marlborough married. Connor's mentioned in past episodes about how a lot of estates were struggling by the start of the 20th century with death duties, taxation, the fall in agricultural prices, and the approach of war. And Blenheim was in a really bad state at the start of the 20th century. And the 9th Duke married Consuelo Vanderbilt, whose family, the Vanderbilt family, are known, of course, for making their money from the railroads in the US. But they're also known for their great patronage of the arts and the building of great houses in America. So some of the largest and grandest stately homes in America are Vanderbilt houses, including the Breakers and a number of other houses, which we'll have seen if our listeners have watched the American version of Downton that Julian Fellowes produced called The Gilded Age. They'll see families like the Vanderbilts and their extraordinary wealth. And that links quite nicely with, of course, Downton, because in Downton, the Earl of Grantham married Cora, who was an American heiress who saved Downton Abbey in the early 20th century. And that relationship was actually based on the marriage of the 9th Duke of Marlborough to Consuelo Vanderbilt. So we saw a lot of this happening across Britain, a lot of country houses, the bringing in of American wealth through marriages to save British country houses.
And today, when you enter Blenheim, if you look up within the portico, you can see the eyes of the 9th Duchess, her blue eyes painted on the ceiling of the portico, which projects above the entrance door. It's upon entering the entrance hall that it's the crescendo roar. If the approach is a concerto and there's a rhythm and the building of the orchestra, when you enter the entrance hall, your eyes raise to the ceiling, but also the giant order Corinthian columns. These are fluted. The capitals have exquisite detail by Grinlin Gibbons. And there is enrichment and ornament in the entablature below the cornice. And if you close the door behind you, you will see the most fascinating door lock, in the sense that a large key, certainly the door lock, the keyhole to a house of this size, a palace, I believe it's based on the door to a European city. But the entrance hall is monumental. And as Ben was saying earlier, in terms of the amount of men who had to labor on its construction, 20 different quarries were used in the construction of Blenheim Palace. And on the estate, there are oak trees in particular, close to 1,000 years old, showing that although Blenheim itself is 300 years old, there was a manor house that predated that. And so the continued nurture, maintenance of an estate in this place has continued unbroken in that sense. And it can be seen in the landscape. When you cross the bridge, it is the most remarkable, monumental, Baroque piece of architecture. But of course, in flooding the lake, which is essentially a dammed river, it fits the landscape a lot better. And that is the work of Capability Brown, 1760s.
Connor, you mentioned Grinling Gibbons, and it's useful to note that he, along with many other great masters of their day, were commissioned both to create beautiful pieces of art, but also monuments to the victory at the Battle of Blenheim. So, for example, the painted ceiling in the hall is by James Thornhill, who famously also painted the painted hall at Greenwich, amongst other great commissions, and it shows the Duke's apotheosis. Then you go under the triumphal arch, where the Duke's marble effigy is, into the painted saloon. What's interesting, I quite like this little piece of trivia, but there's a carving of the English lion eating the French cockerel as a monument to the victory of the English over the French at the Battle of Blenheim. And perhaps the most famous monument at Blenheim is the pediment on the south portico, which is a flat top, which is decorated with a trophy bearing the marble bust of Louis XIV, which was looted by the first Duke of Marlborough in Tournai in 1709. And it weighs 30 tons. So it took a huge amount of effort to get that 30 ton marble bust up onto the pediment. But again, it's loot from warfare. And it reminds us that Blenheim is both this great architectural masterpiece as a country house and home, but it's also a monument to the victory of the English over the French at the Battle of Blenheim.
And the loot of war, the trophies, are very much part of the architecture. You will see cannonballs, armor, swords, pikes in stone, surmounting the end pavilions around the entrance portico, dotted throughout the architecture of this palace, is the signs that this is truly a trophy of British victory. And it, in a way, is the home of the British Empire in that sense. The ownership of the house, interestingly, Queen Anne said that every year, because it was a gift as such from a grateful nation to the Spencer Churchill family, the Duke of Marlborough, on his victories, a reward for his noble service, that a replica of the French royal standard must be presented to the reigning monarch of the day at Windsor Castle every year. And if this symbolic, I suppose, trophy is not passed to the monarch, then the estate will return to the crown.
You mentioned, Connor, the Spencer Churchill family. Of course, John Churchill wasn't a Spencer Churchill. When the house was built for the Churchills. And it's interesting that the dukedom can pass down the female as well as the male line. So the Duke of Marlborough, the first Duke and Duchess, his title was succeeded by his daughter, Henrietta Godolphin, who was the second Duchess of Marlborough. And in turn, her titles passed to her nephew, Charles Spencer, who was the fifth Earl of Sunderland. So that's where the Earldom of Sunderland, which is a subsidiary title of the Dukes of Marlborough, came in. So the title went through the female line into the Spencer family, and they, in order to maintain the inheritance, had to double barrel. So it was in the days of the third Duke of Marlborough that we saw the double barreling of the great Spencers and Churchill families to become the Spencer Churchills that we know of today. So Winston Churchill, our famous wartime prime minister, was actually Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill. He dropped the Spencer to make his name sound more punchy, and he was very proud of his Churchill heritage. But it's just a little background there for our listeners as to why the Churchills became the Spencer Churchills and it was a union of two great aristocratic families, the Spencers being an ancient noble family, of course, whilst the Churchills had risen from a middle-class background through victory and warfare to become one of the great ducal families of England.
And the families still live there in the East Wing. Although the gardens, with all the visitors, it doesn't provide much privacy at all in terms of enjoying the outside. It's important to remember that the gardens that you see today at Blenheim are very much the creation of the ninth Duke, that following the fourth Duke and his employment of Capability Brown, the landscape was very much in the natural, I suppose, Brownian way, which is grass and clumps of trees, oak and chestnut dotted across the landscape, but informal in that sense. And it came right up to the house, as you see with Stowe and so many other great English houses. So it was the Vanderbilt money in that sense that saved the house and introduced new elements internally and in the gardens.
Now, there was a scandal of sorts with this. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, the scandal really was the building of Blenheim. So like all grand families, I'm sure there are many scandals throughout the history of Blenheim. But the big scandal we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation is actually the scandal that revolved around the appointment of Vanbrugh. And of course, we're doing this series on Vanbrugh's houses, so it's important to talk a little more about this. The appointment of Vanbrugh against the Duchess of Marlborough's wishes and about the funding of the palace, because the palace was given by the nation, along with a sizable amount of state money to build this monument. So I think in the end, the Duke of Marlborough contributed to the initial cost when work commenced in 1705. And that was supplemented. So he contributed £60,000, and Parliament agreed to subsidise the building of this great monument. So they voted in Parliament for funds of Blenheim, but no exact sum was mentioned, which, of course, you know, as Connor can testify, if you're given a remit to build a new country house, but you're not given a budget, it's quite easy for costs to spiral and for everything to go out of control. So from the outset, funds were sort of came in stops and starts. Queen Anne contributed some herself, although she frequently fell out with the Duchess. So the funding would start and stop and start and stop. And eventually the Duchess fell from grace and fell out massively with Queen Anne in 1712. And all state money ceased. £220,000, which in the modern day is an astronomical amount, had been spent. And the workmen were still owed £45,000. And this actually forced the Marlboroughs to go into exile on the continent. So having built this remarkable palace, the Duke and Duchess of Marlborough couldn't move into it until after Queen Anne's death in 1714. So on Queen Anne's death, they came back into favour at court, and the Duke decided to complete the project at his own expense. He paid off the debts, resumed work in 1716, and the house was completed, but the Duke died shortly after the completion. In 1722, he passed away. But the Duchess took control because the Duke suffered from a stroke in 1717, 5 years before his death. A severe stroke that meant the Duchess had to take control of the spending. And she was quite thrifty and blamed Vanbrugh entirely for everything. So Vanbrugh became the scapegoat. He was blamed not only for extravagant spending and the design of the palace, which she never liked, but she also blamed him for her fall from grace, her forced exile onto the continent. And so she then ended up bringing in others to complete the work. And as Connor mentioned at the beginning, Vanbrugh was banned from the site, and his wife, who tried to visit the palace in 1725 as a paying member of the public to see this great monument to victory, was herself blocked by the Duchess and told she wasn't welcome, even though the monument was supposed to be for the British public to view.
Yes, well, monument is right rather than house, because it took 25 years to build, and the Duke only lived in it for 3 years, having suffered a stroke in 1717. And it was at that point that the Duchess completely took the reins in terms of completing it. And it was at that point also that Vanbrugh was banned from the site. But it just shows that, of course, the reward for victory on the continent in the construction of this palace, which was much greater than the man himself, it was a palace to victory. Alexander Pope, he paid a visit in 1718, so it's a year after the Duke's stroke, and he had disdain for the building, and he called it in a letter the most proud and extravagant heap of towers in the nation. And it's Alexander Pope's verse, Not to Dwell, which is, I suppose, contemporaneous of the construction, where he says, "See, sir, here's the grand approach. This way is for his grace's coach. There lies the bridge, and here's the clock. Observe the line and the cock." Going back to Sandringham, which we had in a recent episode talking about Sandringham time, Blenheim also had Blenheim time. So it was the fourth Duke, I believe, that instituted Blenheim time in relation to Greenwich. And this was, of course, later changed. But like many estates, its foundation was around country sports. It was a hunting lodge to begin with, just like Versailles in France, a hunting lodge to begin with. And when it comes to creating a dynasty, which is really what the Duke was doing, he lived on the estate properly for 3 years, showing us that what he was doing was for the long term. What the fourth Duke did with the landscape was for the long term, the benefit of future generations. And it's in the knowledge that your descendants will carry on your work and benefit from the work you're putting in today. You will not see the fruits of it, but they will, as you have seen in turn the fruits of your ancestors. Because Blenheim today, and like most country houses, there are family portraits on the walls that the Spencer Churchills can look at, and the eyes and the faces, and they think, are we doing the right thing? Are we doing right by them? It's their work that has brought the house to the place it is today, and to carry on that tradition.
Connor, you mentioned the family tradition and the death of the first Duke. And that links us nicely into the third role of Blenheim Palace. It was built as a home, it was built as a monument, but it was also built as a mausoleum. So there's a chapel at Blenheim, the Palace Chapel, which is where the first Duke and subsequent Dukes are buried. And it's interesting, just thinking about the hubris, perhaps, the grandiosity of the first Duke, that after the first Duke's death, the design of the chapel was altered by the Marlborough's friend, the Earl of Godolphin, who, rather than placing the altar on the east wall, as was custom in churches, they placed the altar on the west wall against convention, allowing the dominating feature of the chapel to be the Duke's enormous tomb and sarcophagus, which was commissioned by the Duchess in 1730 to a design by William Kent, the great architect who worked on so many beautiful country houses and interiors. And William Kent depicted the Duke and Duchess on this sarcophagus and tomb as Caesar and Caesarina. So really elevating the Duke and Duchess to the status of monarch. And I can imagine if Queen Anne had seen it, she probably wouldn't have been too happy at the grandiosity of this move. But at the base relief, at the bottom of the tomb, the Duchess was ordered to be depicted the surrender of Marshal Tallard, so the French nobleman and Marshal of France who surrendered at the Battle of Blenheim. So the theme throughout the palace of honouring the Duke didn't actually reach its peak until the Duchess's death at which point the coffin, the Duke's coffin, was removed, was returned to Blenheim from its temporary resting place at Westminster Abbey. So they were interred. So she had designed this sarcophagus with William Kent, this tomb, but the Duke wasn't there. He was actually temporarily in Westminster Abbey, and it was only after her death that husband and wife were reunited and interred together at the palace chapel. And subsequently, Blenheim has become a pantheon, a mausoleum where successive dukes and their wives are interred in the vault beneath the chapel. Of course, there isn't space in the chapel for all members of the Churchill and Spencer Churchill family to be buried. And so many are buried in the local parish churchyard, not in Woodstock, but in Bladen. And it's in Bladen that you can see the Churchill family plot where Winston Churchill is buried along with other members of his family. So it's very often thought when tourists visit Blenheim that they can easily see Churchill's burial place. But actually Bladen is a good sort of 10-minute drive from Woodstock, a small little village on the Blenheim estate with a very ordinary parish church. But it's where Churchill was buried.
It's interesting that he's depicted in a Caesar fashion on his tomb, because of course on Blenheim Palace, the war trophies are in the Roman tradition. It's Roman armor and a lot of Roman symbology within the sculpture work, but also the crowning glory extending from the house into the landscape, aligned with the front door, the entrance portico, is the Column of Victory, which stands aligned with the palace along a long avenue of trees, and it stands 134 feet tall, and it's crowned by the Duke of Marlborough in the fashion of a Roman general. So he's dressed in stone as a, in fact, not stone, I believe it's bronze. Is it bronze? It's a bronze statue. But he was also made prince of the Holy Roman Empire. So not only a duke of the British Empire, but also a prince of the Holy Roman Empire. So very much the palace is a recognition of his station.
Before we close the episode, I think it would be nice to go back, of course, to Winston Churchill and a little bit of trivia. It's not confirmed if this is true or not. Some say it's a myth or a legend. Others believe it's true. But the story of Churchill's return to his birthplace in his death. So Churchill, Winston Churchill, the great wartime prime minister, asked that he be buried on the Blenheim estate at Bladen. But he apparently, so the legend goes, he had two funeral plans, one for if he outlived Charles de Gaulle and one for if Charles de Gaulle outlived him. Because, of course, Winston had a great rivalry with the French, as did his ancestor, the first Duke of Marlborough. So Winston and Charles de Gaulle never saw eye to eye. And Winston was deeply angered at Charles de Gaulle's surrender to the Nazis during the Second World War. So what Churchill supposedly said was that if he died before Charles de Gaulle, he knew that Charles de Gaulle would be at his funeral. So Churchill said that he wanted his coffin to leave for Blenheim, for Waterloo Station, to remind the French that we had beaten them at the Battle of Waterloo. Now, this was a logistical nightmare because naturally the royal train would go from Paddington Station to Oxfordshire, which is Paddington being on the north bank of the River Thames and near St. Paul's Cathedral, where Churchill's funeral was held. But instead, because he did indeed die before Charles de Gaulle, and Charles de Gaulle was at his funeral, what they had to do during the funeral of Winston Churchill was they had to take his coffin across the River Thames by barge from St. Paul's Cathedral to Waterloo Station. It was then put onto the royal train at Waterloo, and the tracks were then diverted back across the river, so to take the coffin from Waterloo to Oxfordshire. So the legend goes that Churchill had his final revenge on Charles de Gaulle, and that Charles de Gaulle had to stand bareheaded beneath Waterloo as a reminder of the defeat of the French by the British at the Battle of Waterloo. And it's quite a fun piece of trivia that reminds us of the ongoing rivalry between the British and the French, that goes back to long before the Battle of Blenheim, but has continued over the centuries.
Well, indeed, Blenheim Palace is definitely well worth a visit if you can, or if you can't, look it up and look through the images. It, as has been alluded to, it isn't warm and cozy as some of the other houses we've discussed are. Even when you're in the state dining room, of course, you have painted people looking over you as you walk through it, which is quite a unique experience. But there is so much to see if you go. We've talked about many of those things, but you know, the Willis organ in the Long Library, there's a Roman sarcophagus that's 1700 years old that they didn't know about. They actually used it as a tub in the garden to fill with flowers. The long vaulted corridors, monuments, incredible art, beautiful gardens. It really is. Do go and see it. And of course, I should say before closing, I alluded to at the end of last week's episode about a Harry Potter being filmed there. And I can confirm the Cedar of Lebanon on the bank of the lake is where Severus Snape in a flashback is bullied by Harry Potter's father, I believe. So you can go and see that too if you're a Harry Potter film. But we should end as we began with that Alexander Pope quoting when he visited Blenheim Palace. But where do you sleep or where do you dine? I find by all you have been telling that 'tis a house, but not a dwelling. So thank you for joining us. Hope you've enjoyed it and we'll see you next week. Goodbye.